Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Richard Herring. You're about to listen to my Leicester Square Theatre podcast. If you're enjoying these and you'd like to help us to do even more, then you can pay us back in a variety of ways. One of them is to go to www.gofasterstripe.com/podcasts and download the video rather than the audio. It costs a small amount to do this, but all that money we ploughed back into making new comedy. We're not a big business. We're not out to make money out of this. We just want to try and see how far we can push the genre. You can also buy DVDs and books of mine at gofasterstripe.com if you don't feel like you should pay for podcasts. But it'd be lovely if you were to pay. And if you don't want to pay, then please spread the news about this podcast to your friends and see if we can get more listeners. That would be fantastic. Hope you enjoy the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. He may be quite old, but he can still do it two times in a night. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. As all the cool kids are calling it, Rehellastapa. Oh, you're much better than last week's audience. Hooray! I've always wanted to do that, and I have done it before. How are we doing? Some new people. The butlers are here again. I've got just show people the audience. The mistake I was making when I was trying to film through the viewfinder. I realised that's there for me. There you go. They're both butlers. He's a nuclear physicist. He's lost his hat. He's just, I don't know who he is. He's just weird. He kind of comes to all the gigs. What's your name, sir?
Stuart.
Good name. Want to do a double act? What do you do for a living?
I run a pub.
You run a pub? You're fantastic. Brilliant. Whereabouts?
In Cranley.
That's quite a nice little area, Cranley. What's the pub called? Give it a little...
The Richard Onslow.
Who was Richard Onslow?
He was the MP of Guildford.
He was the MP of Guildford.
His nickname was Stiff Dick.
His nickname was... Are you trying to get on QI or something? Is that what you've turned up for? I've got lots of... What is the best drink you have ever made?
Red wine with a splash of cola.
Wow, red wine with a splash of cola. They do things weird in Cranley. And is this your friend and your lady, your daughter?
What is
my, it's my girlfriend.
Your girlfriend's very nice. What's your name?
Karen.
Karen? You went, Karen, like you were trying to think, what's the most ridiculous name I can make up? And it was pretty, you did well. Karen. My parents couldn't spell Karen, is that there?
No, my mum was a fan of
Bananarama. Oh, was Karen in Bananarama? Don't remember her. Siobhan, I remember. Which one was Karen in Bananarama?
Dark.
She was the sexy one. Yeah, why do I not know her name? She was a good one. What do you work in the pub? Did you work as a barmaid? He kind of got, he's sort of forced you to go out because you're, to be honest, you're a lot better looking than him. So for once, we could blur. They're looking at people at home, then look at that. Something's going on, isn't it?
What? I work in the same pub, but I work for a train company now.
You work for a train company? Is it the Holocaust Railways? Little back reference to last week's, last time's podcast. I don't know what they're doing. Very excited to be here. I've been in Glasgow last week recording a radio show, but I stayed at the best hotel in Glasgow, the Premier Inn. Got to be the best. It's called the Premier. It's got to be the best one. And then I was a bit annoyed because I looked up the road, Socky Hall Street in Glasgow. There's another Premier Inn at the other end of Socky Hall Street. Which one's the Premier Inn? Make your mind up, Glasgow. It can't be both the Premier one. But my favourite thing that happened while I was there was I went down for breakfast and they have somebody greets you and says, you know, have you been here before for breakfast and stuff like that. And as I was leaving one time, and a couple came down and the woman greeting him said, have you had breakfast before? And he said, not here. Like he seriously thought she might have been worried that he'd never... No, I don't. Breakfast? What? I'm 35 years old. I've never heard what you can eat before lunchtime. What is this? Strange necromancy. So I did enjoy it. I think he knew, but he still felt he had to just clarify. Not. Yeah, I've had breakfast before. Sure, I'm suspicious that he hasn't had breakfast before. Look, we've had some fun with there. That was a lot of fun, and you're all warmed up now. So I think it is time to introduce this week's guest, this episode's guest. He is best known for writing 2 episodes of Dr. Snuggles, which is fucking awesome. I can't wait to talk to him about that. We please welcome John Lloyd, ladies and gentlemen. Come in, John. Help yourself to a mic. Well, how are you doing? You all right?
Yes.
Looking very smart. That's very nice.
Yes. Going on somewhere more exciting later.
I suspect so. Stephen Fry last week got a phone call from the director William Friedkin. So that's the guy who was just going, yeah, I'm just going out to see my friend who directed The Exorcist. So Dr. Snuggles, do you remember much about writing Dr. Snuggles?
I remember a little bit, yeah. I used to write them with Douglas Adams.
Yeah.
What I can remember is reaction there. I remember the producer was called Joop Fish. He was Dutch, and his secretary was called Veronica Plink. I'm sure it's pronounced differently in Dutch, but it was very funny at the time. Yeah,
it's quite a surreal, weird. I vaguely remember it, Dr. Snuggles. I don't know what year that was. I probably was too old to be watching kids' TV.
It would have been the mid-70s.
No, it's probably all right then, but it was kind of... Dr. Snuggles, slightly psychedelic or something weird.
And Peter Ustinov did the voiceover.
He did.
Yeah, and Douglas and I used to moonlight in the evenings. We were both radio producers.
Yeah.
We got 500 quid an episode, which was absolutely, you know, could buy a house with that in 1975. Marvellous.
And how did you get, we'll get right on to Douglas Adams, we'll get this out of the way, because that's probably the thing you get asked out about a lot, but how did you two get together and start writing together, working together?
We met at Cambridge, and we both ran a college review. So in those days, Footlights was considered a very naff thing to do. It was lots of rather nice men in velvet jackets. Hello, my dear, you look very attractive. And so you tended to avoid that in those days. And so college review was very cool when we were there, 70, 73, or Douglas, 71, 74. And so I ran a thing called the Trinity Review, and Douglas was next door at St. John's, and he had a thing called Adam Smith Adams.
Right.
So that's how we met. And we didn't really know each other very well at Cambridge, and afterwards we just became about as good friends as you can be, really. We were very, very close. We spent a lot of time together trying to write things, and spent a lot of time eating hamburgers at a place called Tootsie's, I remember, very, very... very good hamburger chain it was, and we shared various flats together, and what can I say, it was fantastic fun. Douglas was a very, very funny and interesting guy, and in those days, when young, incredibly open-minded, you know, he was willing to espouse any idea, which is what made Hitchhiker so brilliant.
Yeah.
And as he got older, he kind of sort of settled into a set of opinions which were very ossified, in my opinion,
right.
Slightly.
Such what, in what way? What sort of opinions?
Well, he was a... He introduced Richard Dawkins to his wife, Lala.
Yes.
And Dawkins basically converted Douglas from an agnostic to a sort of card-carrying atheist.
Yeah. And you became quite strident as an atheist.
Well, it was just kind of... I have a thing. I'm not... I don't espouse any religious faith, but I don't consider atheism in that way a scientific position. It's kind of like... You know, like I don't know whether there are little green men in flying saucers either, but I don't go and shout at people who think there are.
Yeah.
So I
maybe we should. Maybe that's where you're heading afterwards.
but I think it's and I think a lot of people say, oh, you know, science doesn't get enough of a voice in society. I think that's rubbish. I think it gets an enormous voice, and yeah. I also think that the idea that, you know, we're swamped by mad religious people is not true. There are actually an extremely small number of mad religious people. Unfortunately, they have inordinate influence in terms of blowing people up for no reason and so forth. But it's just in terms of the business of what the point of anything is, really.
Yeah.
And I struggle, though I have for many years... I haven't worked it all out yet, but I can't believe that life is meaningless. Does anyone really genuinely feel that life is completely meaningless? It doesn't feel meaningless, does it? It feels confusing and annoying and frustrating, but meaningless it doesn't.
Yeah, mate, you create your own meaning, though. It could still be meaningless, but, you know, you create your own meaning within the meaninglessness. I fucking failed the QI audition, that's it. Mate... Did so well last week with Stephen. Dawkins is interesting because I'm a big fan of his work, but if you follow him on Twitter, he's a massive prick. He just retweets it all, every single bit of praise for himself. He retweets everything. It's the worst thing you can do on Twitter. And then every single argument, he'll have it like massively out in the open. Am I the only one who thinks? I mean, he's worth following. It's massively entertaining, but he's a massive dick, but he is married to an ex Doctor Who assistant, so you know, yeah.
There's a word for it.
Not Adric, one of the good ones.
Well, one of the things I did with Douglas in 1983, wrote a book called The Meaning of Life,
yes.
Which is still in print after amazingly 30 years this year. And John Cantor, one of Douglas's other great friends, and I've rewritten a thing called After Life, slightly yes. In homage to Douglas. And there's a word for exactly that person.
Right.
Someone who retweets praise about themselves on Twitter. And it's a toot-garouk. Okay? So that is obviously all Richard is.
Yes, a little bit. He is a little bit. But you wrote some of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So you wrote from the radio, the last couple of episodes of the radio, first series of the radio show.
Well, it was kind of natural because we wrote lots of stuff together. We didn't get made. We wrote a film treatment for Robert Stigwood about the Guinness Book of Records, about an alien race who are very good at athletics and you know, jumping and swimming and all that, and they said they wouldn't destroy the world if we could beat them at an athletics competition, and though they won all the athletics events, we won all the, you know, how many people can you fit in a mini and how many girls can you eat in 20 minutes and all that kind of stuff. So we thought that's great. We also wrote a brilliant sitcom called, it's a rather complicated title, you have to be a bit of an astronomer, it's called Snow Seven and the White Dwarves. And it was about two astronomers.
There's an astronomer in there in the middle. Yeah. We can pick
two astronomers sharing a house and an observatory at the top of Everest, which is apparently the best place you could have one.
Yeah.
One of whom is very untidy, one is very tidy. That was also another very good thing. And Dr. Snuggles, perhaps our only real success until Hitchhiker came along. And as you know, Douglas was famous for missing deadlines. So after about four episodes of Hitchhiker. He was driving the producer and the production team completely insane. It had taken him nearly a year to write the first four, and he asked me if I would help him out in the last two, and we knocked them off very happily in the next couple of weeks.
So. Right. It was weird that he did seem to struggle to write, because what he wrote was so great. In fact, part of the impetus behind me sort of starting to get back into writing loads of blogs and doing loads of podcasts was reading The Salmon of Doubt and seeing all these kind of ideas that he was working on and that he got a certain way with, and thinking all the stuff that he didn't do, you know, all the stuff that he didn't achieve even within the time he was here, he seemed to like spend a lot of time not writing. Is that fair to say? Or finding it difficult to write?
It's absolutely fair. He would, I'm not telling tales, because he would be the first to admit, yeah. You know, I love deadlines, I love the sound of them whooshing by, he used to say. But this is just about, I don't want to be too sort of spiritually weird or anything, but this is the thing, is what drives somebody who absolutely hated the business of writing to make his living as one? It's rather like Richard Curtis pointed out to me, it's the oddest thing that Rowan Atkinson, the shyest man possibly in the universe, is probably one of the 10 most famous people in the world. Why would you do that to yourself, you know? He always said because it was the only way he could think of affording the cars he liked. Yeah. I mean, that's true. But it's that thing, and I must tell you this great story, another thing Richard Curtis told me, which when one of the several autobiographies came out about Douglas after he died, I put this in the intro. It's written by a guy called M.J. Simpson, who was chairman of his fan club.
Right.
And Richard and Douglas had planned to have lunch in London. You know, they're all friends. And on the way to lunch, Richard said, and how are you, Douglas? As you would. And Douglas said, and he's very puzzled in that way. He goes, yeah, I'm fine, but do you know, it's funny, I've been thinking about life, the universe and everything, and I think I actually have got the real answer. So Richard thinks, well, it's going to turn a bit spooky all of a sudden. So he says, well, Richard thinks to himself, I could go two routes now. I can either say, my God, Douglas, have you? What's that then? And knowing that Douglas liked to talk, that would be the end of Richard's conversation during lunch. Douglas would just expound this amazing theory and he'd never get to catch up on all the gossip, you know. Or he could say, says Richard, and how's Jane? Oh, well done, Douglas, and how's Jane? So that's what Richard opted to do. So he said, oh, really, Douglas, and how's Jane? Anyway, 3 months later, Douglas died, and Richard's been kicking himself ever since. Because of all the people I've ever met in my life, Douglas is the one person who actually had a chance of discovering what it is.
And... So the first thing that introduced me to your work without really, I guess I wouldn't necessarily have known it, was Not at 9 o'clock News, I think, was probably the first.
You've got a lot of awards here, haven't you?
I put them two. This is just from this year. That's bronze. That's better than gold. So I just put that, they're there to intimidate you. I know, yeah. You won't have probably got a Chortle Award, so but you have. But Not That Got News was one of the, well, because I'd really loved Monty Python, but I was a bit too young for Monty Python, so I got to Monty Python through all the records and everything. And like in those days, comedy shows like came along about once every 10 years, it seemed. And Not That Got News was one of these things that kind of came out. We were all really excited at school about this new show, and then I think, is this right? It was meant to start, and then it didn't start. Is that right? The first series that there was an episode pending,
yeah.
And then was it because of the Shah of Iran or something, or the Ayatollah taken off?
Yeah, it was. This is how different television is today than it was in 1979 when I'd helped invent a couple of formats that had been taken to television, but without me. And I was a bit cross, and I went to go and ask essentially for a job as a production manager, and I walked in the head of department's office in television, Jimmy Gilbert, who'd started the Frost Report, and his first words were, what kept you? I said, you don't even know who I am. He said, oh yes we do, we've heard all your shows, they're very good, we thought you'd never make a producer if you can't be bothered to bloody ask for a job, so we've earmarked 6 half-hours for you to make a new series with, and there's no rules except it has to be funny, it has to be contemporary, and we thought we'd call it Sacred Cows, but you don't have to use that title if you don't want to. So there I was. I thought, oh, that's just a lot easier than I thought. The only condition was I had to go and see a guy called Sean Hardy, who's this lunatic current affairs producer who kept putting jokes into Panorama, and they didn't want him anymore. So, you like radio too, and radio is basically a very simple medium, and there's not sort of clutter. You don't have to worry about car parking or catering, or just get on, do the jokes, whatever. So I used to make three of those a week in the 5 years I was in Radio 4. So having got this news, I took a week off skiing, which is an amazingly stupid thing to do. And in the run-up to what was going to be the first of six, it's now called the pilot, but it's actually the first of series one, it suddenly became clear to me and Sean that all the material we had was going to go into that first episode, and what the hell we were going to do the following Monday, we literally had no idea. And it was actually the last time I can remember that there was the wind that an election would be in the air. And we'd made the show on sort of Tuesday, it was going to go up on the following weekend. And election's always called on a Thursday. And on Wednesday night, for the last time in my life, I actually knelt by my bed and prayed to God, please let election be called. And there was. And so it was all cancelled. The pilot, I don't know if I've ever seen it online, but Mel Smith, who wasn't in it, described it as the single worst half hour of television he'd ever seen. And I often say, when I put in these positions, being asking questions, is it's a very important thing in life. I express as disaster as a gift, that very often, you know, bad things that happen are often the making of you.
So, yes.
And that was one thing. I'd learned my lesson very, very fast on that. And
so you got delayed by 6 months or
yeah,
so. Yeah.
And then we were able to rethink it. And Rowan and Chris Lang were the two people who survived from the cast. Managed to get Mel, who I'd always wanted, and I met Pamela Stevenson, as I've said before, at a party, and fell in love with her and thought, you've got to have her, so.
And then it all went off, because we were furious. I thought there was some kind of... I never actually found out. I never really bothered to check it, but at the time I remember thinking there was some kind of BBC conspiracy, because it looked like a really exciting... You know, the next thing that really hit was the young ones for me. It was after that when I was a little bit older. But
you see them dotted through history, don't you? There's, for people younger than me, there's a Goon Show, and then there's Monty Python's My Student Thing, and then there's Not That I Got News, and there's the young ones, there's the Fast Show. There's a string of them, and we don't really have one. It's the show. I call it the show that tells 15-year-old boys what to think. we need those to have, and it's just fascinating. Like. Look what Not the 9 o'clock News became. It was considered to be a political act, so I was told, that somebody very high up in the system had said, where's the new Monty Python? We haven't had anything for 10 years. You've got to pull your finger out. And Light and Tone was this incredibly powerful, world-famous organisation, which turned out wonderful shows. And they, I think, slightly reluctantly decided to get these two loonies, one from radio and one from Current Affairs, to see what they could come up with. I'll tell you, everyone on that show was a trainee apart from the floor manager. There was the director who'd just come straight off his course. The secretary had been a receptionist. The production assistant had been a secretary. Nobody had any idea what they were doing. So we fumbled around for the first, you know, three or four. It started to get really good with a sketch called Life of Python, which was largely improvised, with Rowan playing a bishop and Mel playing Alexander Walker, the film critic, and where they'd made this blasphemous film about our Lord J.C., quite obviously our Lord John Cleese, the Messiah, the comic Messiah. And it was a very naughty thing to do, because Python, and to our generation, when you didn't criticise them. So it started to come good, and then so at the end of the series they said, well, we'll give you another go. BBC won't do that anymore if it's not huge at the beginning.
Well, and also you can't just walk in and go, they don't go, oh yeah, we've been waiting for you to come. I might try it tomorrow, I might try and walk in. Oh yeah, we've been waiting for you. Oh, sorry, I didn't realise you've been waiting.
But the thing is, particularly in jokes, that's the only way it works. You find people who are talented or potentially talented, and you trust them and you let them learn. And that's the way actually you should teach children, as it happens, not tell people how to do it. And this hopeless system now where... any idea that you take to anybody is filleted by committees and hierarchies of people until what remains of the original idea is not there. And then you make a pilot, it doesn't work. They say, it didn't really work. Say, no, but that's your idea. You made it like that.
Well, it's true. And all the things I think that were, you know, even from On the Hour, which I was involved in with Armando Iannucci, they just let him get on with stuff and it's always great. And The Office, obviously, they just let them get on with it and they nearly just dumped it and... you know, because it wasn't put together by committee, but it just seemed to be very hard to get these. And when Monty Python was the same thing, wasn't it? They just walked into the office and said, oh, go and have 8 programmes and you can do whatever you like in them, basically.
Well,
I think
put it together. He'd seen Palin and Jones in one place and on the footlights, Locke, Cleese, and so on in the other place and stuck them together and thought they might get on.
Yeah.
They didn't actually at all, but it was to argue all the time. But they did great work, amazing work.
But I got, not 1982, the big calendar book, in our school, like we were all given, I think I'd won a prize and I was allowed to pick any book. And I picked the not 82 book, and my dad was quite cross with me. I think it's fair to say, though, that as a comedy fan, the 9 o'clock news books were a law of diminishing return. The first ones are great, and then the last couple, were you cashing in a bit on those, do you think? As then this is the 14-year-old me coming back. I wasted a couple of Christmas presents.
As in life, you know, QI's been running, 11 years, and it's the hardest thing is to keep up the keep up the fresh approach to it. It's not easy. Yeah. I see a lot of people here much younger than me or even you, and they probably won't remember Not the 9 o'clock News, but, you know, it's hard to imagine just how famous it was. It was like a mixture of Little Britain and The Office all rolled into one, and we were on the front page of the newspapers quite often. Pamela Stevenson was the sexiest, you know, girl in the world, and Rowan was this amazing discovery, not necessarily by me. And you know, the ratings went up by 1 million a week, and after the first series, they did a compilation from that first series, which was in many ways the weakest of the four. And he got 17 million viewers on BBC One. It was just massive. But you could be in those days, and it's that was not an unheard of number. But you don't get those kind of numbers by poring over everything and taking low risk decisions and doing something a little bit like what was done last week. You do them by taking an act of incredible daring. That's how it pays off, I think.
It was great. I remember I borrowed Phil Fry's copy of Hedgehog Sandwich. It was on LP. And I scratched it because I was trying to learn all the words to the songs, so I had to buy another copy.
But you're right. Of course, we did four years. In fact, oddly enough, I found myself, as you do late at night, pissed on YouTube, and I found an old Not the 9 o'clock News from the fourth series.
Right.
And I watched this through, and I thought, this is seriously good. And you know that thing when you look at things you did when you were younger and you think, I'm not that good, I don't know how I did that?
Yes.
But as I watched through... As I watched it through, you could see it was already getting, you know, fame and money is not good for people. I'm lucky that I'm not very, I'm not at all famous, and I've surprisingly little money for the contribution I've made. And it's good because you have to keep going, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I remember when Steve Coogan did a couple of series on telly and discovered he had a Ferrari addiction. You should be so lucky, you know? Oh, I've got this terrible Ferrari addiction, doctor. I got to buy another one. I don't know what I'm going to do if I get another one. And that was, you know, back in the day, I often say that people like the two Ronnies, you know, Ronnie Barker worked in telly for, I don't know, 40 years or something. You know, had a nice house in Chipping Norton, for all I know, a little cabin cruiser on the Thames at Reading, but he wasn't a millionaire, billionaire, you know.
But like a lot of people that you've worked with have gone on to be the richest people in the world.
Yeah,
is that hard, isn't it? I mean, and for me as well, I have to say. It's the same thing.
I know, it's hard.
Is that hard to cope with? Because is that...
Well, it depends how much value do you place on money. In my case, you know, enough is nice, but too much is clearly not very good for you. Yeah. I mean, I don't see any evidence that, for example, Douglas became any happier for it. I don't, you know, for somebody who can't hit back on Twitter at me, for example. But I think that what tends to happen, I know this from 10 years, more than 10 years in advertising, after the third series of Blackadder, some idiot offered me a job directing a television commercial. I'd only directed one thing, which is a pop video, before. And we spent 5 months talking about the script for this thing, and I said to these two guys from the agency, how many of these ads do you do in a year? And they said, about two ads? It's what, 2 1-minute ads? And no, 2 30-second ads, they said. And when I saw what I got paid, well, first of all, the budget for these 2 1-minute commercials that I did was the same as 3 episodes of Blackadder. And then when I got paid, I thought, well, my God, if I do 4 more of these, I can retire. It's fantastic. And it was great the first few years, first 3 years doing it, because you get all the toys you can't afford on the BBC, the helicopters and the aircraft carriers and all that kind of thing. And then I suddenly found myself in a position where I had more money than I could easily spend. And I didn't enjoy it very much. And, you know, you kind of hit the buffers. You think, well, what now? You know, I've got all the things that I need, and now I don't want anything else. Now what do I do about it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what started to happen with Not the 9 O'Clock News, you know, that you can't, once you've had the success, you know, which you've craved at all your teenage years or whatever, and suddenly you start to do things and you start to take it for granted, and you think you've got the secret. And that's when you start to get shit, basically. That's when you start to get worse. You see it with stand-ups, don't you?
You do. I think it's completely true. I mean, I feel quite lucky that... I mean, the only thing that
you
I...
You haven't peaked yet, Richard,
the only thing I ever did that made money was when I wrote Time General Police for Al Murray, which was like 36... We did 35 episodes in 2 years, and I wrote pretty much all of it, and it was well paid. And I suddenly had a lot of money, and I didn't know what to do, because we'd made no money up to there. So what I did was bought a house that was too big, so that I would then have to
pay more earning money. I'm the same exactly what I have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I have to carry. I've still got a big mortgage, so I've got to carry on working. Yeah. But I think it does. You definitely see. You know, why bother putting all this work? Why bother doing 5 years of fucking free podcasts for idiots? if you've got loads and loads of money. So you know, so I think it does keep you definitely artistically. I think with me and Stu, we got to a point where. The BBC had given us more series, it could have taken off in a way that Little Britain did, probably not to the same extent, but it could have been that. And you kind of think, thank God it didn't, because you know, we would have both gone crazy in different ways, but also coasted on that and then not done the things we've done in the last 10 years.
It's really hard to survive success when young and money. I know I often say this to people, you know, it's actually much easier to be a failure than to be a big success. I know it sounds ridiculous, but the universe, in my view, is built on paradoxes. You know, the paradox of quantum mechanics and relativity that don't match. They disagree with each other, and they always will, because that's what the universe is built on, is paradoxes. Plus one and minus one, matter and antimatter. There's nothing really here. It's a zero energy sum, as they say. So that, and one of them is this, you know, thing that you won't... I've lost my thread, Richard.
It was good.
I was off for the fairies for a moment. I can't get back.
I can't really help you. We've got a nuclear physicist here. Was he right about the and quantum mechanics? Definitely right. There we go. Look, that's I make sure that the front row is inhabited by. There's an astrologer further back. This is a nuclear physicist. So if you need any,
well, it's the. Almost the most wonderful thing that happened to me recently in the last couple of years, I was on Brian Cox's show, The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Yeah.
Which is a show I really like. And on it was Sir Martin Rees, or Lord Rees, as we call him, the astronomer royal, who happened to be master of my old college, and I knew very slightly. And we were talking about parallel universes, and I've been saying now for at least 15 years, the Big Bang Theory will never stack up. It's going to fall to bits. In the next 20 years, I said. And Martin started talking about this on the show, saying, of course, it is all crumbling. We think there may be little bangs. There's, you know, all sorts of quantum fluctuations. There may even be something in Fred Hoyle's steady state theory. You know, we don't know anything about how the universe began. It's just a guess.
Yeah.
And similarly, when you go into quantum mechanics, you know, God, I wish somebody told me about quantum mechanics when I was at school, instead of the physics that we were taught, which is, you know, spring balances and inclined planes and pointless things you had to remember, rather than this amazing imaginative universe, which is just fantastic, even just to think about, you know, what a lepton does, and, you know, how an atom's constructed, and, you know, and this Higgs boson thing is another thing that interests me. Even Peter Higgs has started to say, I wish they'd stop going on about the Higgs boson. There are other things they're doing there. It's not going to solve the... Do you know why it's called the God particle, the Higgs boson?
Because it's the missing part of the universe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so not. It's not, and serious physicists don't think that either. The reason why it's called that is a book called Leon, by a Nobel Prize winning physics laureate called Leon Lederman, wrote a book, and he wanted to call it the goddamn particle because it was so fucking difficult to find. And the publisher said, we can't call it that because it'll put off the Christian movement, so we'll call it the God particle and maybe get some of those in. So that's where it comes from.
Is that right? It doesn't know. There you go. It's beyond
very
you.
It's gone beyond.
But you spent like, because you've spent kind of 10 years trying to find the meaning of life, basically, is what led up to QI. You kind of got depressed after, at what point you kind of lost faith in everything a little bit and then spent some time.
Well, it's partly, there were a number of reasons. I mean, I got to the point where I had everything I could conceivably want, you know, houses and children and all, lots of things I didn't expect to have, and plenty of prizes, a lot more than those, I can tell you.
You got a bronze one.
I've got one of those.
Is yours coming to bit? Look, mine's sort of coming, all coming off.
But, it's
like a house of cards.
And then two things happened. Working in advertising is not good for the soul, and having children is very difficult if you are used to running things. You know, I was running very big, very difficult to run television series, and you have to become a bit of an autocrat. If you're running Spitting Image, somebody has to have final cut, and it was me. And then when a two-year-old is bouncing on the bed and won't stop immediately, it's very, very annoying. And then, and particularly Harry, my oldest, now 22, used to ask these very difficult questions. Like, you know, I got to the age of 40 on thinking, I really know a lot. I'm pretty good, actually. I've won, you know, more BAFTA awards than anybody else, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Harry used to say things like, Dad, does God look after burglars? It's quite difficult. And then is particularly one I particularly like, well, and why is there something and not nothing? You know, that's a hell of a good question for a child, isn't it? Not one that physics can answer, I think I'm right in saying. And then he said, Dad, you know, you keep saying to me, if you watch too much television, you get square eyes. I said, yeah. He said, why don't they make an eye-shaped television that I can watch it as often as I like? So I got all these questions from the kids, and it started to drive me mad. And then I got fired from a lot of things all at once. I've been fired a lot of times by people. Yeah. I thought very unfair, and I got very cross about that. And yeah, I sat down to think, okay, well, I didn't see the point of going on. So I sat down to, you know, read a lot of physics, a lot of Greek philosophy initially, mathematics, started thinking about, and then just went the whole... That's where QI comes from, basically, reading far too many books about different things.
Yeah.
And you start thinking, well, first of all, I think you can, if you're seriously interested, you want to know what the meaning of life might be, I think you'd take you about 3 years of solid work. And then the rest of your life is trying to live in such a way as to make that meaningfulness meaningful and to do it properly. And that's very, very difficult. I haven't got anywhere in that at all.
So you know the meaning of life, you just don't know how to put it into practice.
Well, I don't. I fail continually at behaving optimally, as it were, in order to make the most of the short span that we have. Apparently,
do you think?
Am I going to tell you what it is?
Yeah, well, you can tell me what it is, but also apparently, you think you might live longer. Do you think there's life after? I'm doing a show about death. This is my next show.
Yes,
I don't think there is life after death. Do you think there is life after death?
Well, it depends what you mean. You have to define your terms. Do you know this thing? Do you know my faith at the moment is agnosticism? Do you know this? Anyone seen my TED talk online? Anyone seen that? Agnostics are a brilliant concept. Agnostics are people who refuse to discuss whether God exists or not until the terms are defined.
Right.
Okay, so you tell me what kind of God I don't believe in, and then I'll tell you whether I agree or not. So can we agree, you know, I mean, how tall? Robe or not? Gimlet eye? Large forearms? Does he wear sandals or not, you know? Does he get Sundays off? I mean, you know, when we work on some of this stuff, and then this is why atheism's so silly. What? Not believe in what? What is it? Which is the God you don't believe in apart from all of them?
Well, do you not think you can, if you look at history, you can work out where all gods were created by mankind? You can sort of work it backwards and reverse engineer and go, well, this God came about because the people in the north, the Vikings didn't understand why it went dark in the winter, so they created this god who flies across the sky and covers up the sun for 3 months or 4 months, or whatever. So you can work out backwards. They're trying to answer everything.
You don't think they really believe that, do you?
Well, I don't know, but you wouldn't think people would believe any of the things that they get told. Most of the things that religion seems to espouse seem to be made up to make children comfortable with unpleasant thoughts.
Well, I agree at the childish level, and the thing is that it's what Richard Dawkins has a thing is he's basically arguing against two things: terrorism, which we all sign up to, that kind of stuff, and kindergarten Christianity, you know, which is, yeah, but there's other levels of it. If you read St. Augustine, you think, okay, this guy's a seriously bright guy, as no doubt were some of these loony Vikings you talk about. They're probably... Yeah. And atheism's always been there. There have always been people who don't sign up to the religions of the day. And the other thing is interesting is that heresy, which is continually stamped out by the Christian church, but also happens in Islam as well, all these people have the interesting ideas. The heretics say, well, it's not really like that. You see, Jesus wasn't really the Son of God because God isn't a real guy. Do you get it? It's like, it's kind of a metaphor for something else, for something you can, probably if you know anything about Buddhism or Taoism, you could sign up things like the way, you know, the pattern. There's a grid, you know, if you think about physics in terms of, there's some ideas in physics about the field. You know, we don't understand gravity. We don't understand why it's patchy across the universe. You know, you and I think, oh, they know all about gravity, physicists. No, they don't. It's the least understood of the four fundamental forces. They don't know about that. Do you know how many chemicals there are in a wild carrot, Richard?
I do not know.
Well, roughly.
One?
Yeah. Well, they think it's about 114, but they're kind of... wild carrot's a very complicated thing, as is a mouse or a hedgehog. Yeah. You know, we don't really understand... You can't make a wild carrot. You don't even know how many chemicals are there. You probably don't even know what colour one is.
Orange.
Wrong. And yet people are happy to say, oh yeah, I'm an atheist, as if it's kind of like, that's a really original idea. Well done. You know, it's not personal. It's just that what all these years of QI has taught me, and the 10 years before it, is that you better be awfully certain before you say anything that you know definitely to be true. You know, it's not, or untrue, because, you know, the history of science is the history of people changing their mind about things, you know.
It is, but also, you know, science has achieved a certain amount of stuff that makes you think, well, they're heading in the right direction. Science has allowed me to fly, whereas religion has not allowed me to fly. So, you know, yeah. You sort of sense that the scientists...
And have you put that flying to good use, do you think?
Well, yeah, I've been to the Maldives. Quite nice. Before it goes under the sea.
No, I mean, I agree, science, but I mean, I really, it's not what I'm particularly interested in. I mean, I think it's like, I often say to Robin Ince, who, you know, who I've bumped into from time to time, it's odd, isn't it, Robin, that you talk about religion all the time and you're an atheist, and I hardly ever mention it, and I don't know what I think. It's odd. And same with Richard, you know, he should be doing his biology. Go and be like Steve Jones and look at a few more snails, you know.
No, I agree with that. Stop retweeting.
You know, because we don't need another lecture on the Ten Commandments and how crap they are, you know.
Should see my show, Christ in a Mic.
Well, it's not personal. It's just,
no, it's, you know. No, no. I think it's, you know, I just think I can't see. Well, if there is a creator, why he's bothered doing it? That's the, or he or she, or what's in it for them?
Well, I know. Let's take that as an argument. I mean, the two things, you know, this is just playing devil's advocate. So I'm not signed up anything. So, what do you and I know about creativity and how it works? What it is a series of fudges and improvements, isn't it? You try this, it doesn't quite work. You know, you try your stuff in a little pub and it doesn't work. So you try a bit more. You try a bit. Oh, that's a good idea. That works. I'll have that. And eventually you come up, if you're lucky, with something that's a really good hour-long set. That's how creativity works. That's what we know. So the idea is, well, obviously there can't be a creator because there's so many mistakes. But that would lead me to think, then that's probably because it's a created universe. Because you can see the errors and the tryouts and so on. You know, duck-billed platypus, clearly there's, you know, tried a few bits, they didn't stick together off. Just keep that over there for a minute.
But, well, you know, there's not to say that the universe wasn't created by someone, but if it, or something, but if it was created, it doesn't mean that they're
but
still
no,
around.
As I say, you're the guy who doesn't know what's in a carrot, for example. Now, the thing is, when you go on
the test of that. You've just chosen an arbitrary carrot. If it had been a cucumber, I could have told you, but you've decided it's a carrot.
No, I mean, but let's say if... let's say there is some entity that's clever enough to have created the world as we see around us and all the galaxies and so forth. How do you think you would be able to work out what their possible motive was for that? I mean, how clever would you have to be to even get some sort of grasp of what's going on there?
Well, I don't think I'm that clever, but I just wouldn't have bothered. So if I had the power to do that, I wouldn't bother to watch out whether a man was sticking his winky in the man's bottom and get cross about it. If I had the ability to create all the galaxies, and that's I guess where I have a problem.
Well, yeah, just before I get lynched by this audience here, I would say that I'm putting these things to you because they're the questions that started me thinking.
Yeah.
And as a result, I haven't, since I started thinking about it, I haven't been able to go. I do go to people's weddings and all kinds of things, but I can't really go to church anymore because I've seen under the blanket, and I know, you know, that that people are looking the wrong direction. Okay. When I found out, for example, as Isaac Newton did, that the Bible was completely rewritten at the orders of Emperor Constantine in the 4th century by Bishop, now Saint Athanasius of Alexandria, to make it fit better with what the Romans wanted. You know, it's a one-chance thing. The early Christians all believed in the transmigration of souls, reincarnation, and so forth. And that was all got out. You know, you want a religion where do what you're told or you go to hell. When you know that, and then you hear people say, well, the Bible's the word of God. Well, it isn't. It's the word of Saint Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria. That's the end of it. And when I heard this, I went and reread Genesis. Well, I hadn't ever read the whole book before, even as a schoolboy. But I have been 30-odd years as a script editor. But when you read Genesis, it's so obviously terribly badly cut and pasted. There's about four stories all glued together in a terrible hurry.
Yeah.
So you think, that is not the work, obviously not the work of God. It's not even the work of, you know, any particular scholar. It's somebody ham-fistedly bashing together.
Yeah. Ham-fistedly, that's good.
I think you know what my choice is going to be, ladies and gentlemen.
We might never get.
I'm sorry.
There,
I know you just. I know you just want knob gags, really. But I have people to do that for me.
No, I want to. I want to know that. Well, my show's in the autumn's about the meaning of life, which I'm going to try and get into.
Do you think there is any?
I think it just comes down to. It doesn't matter if there is or not. I think we're probably never going to know if there is. So I think the meaning of life is to understand how incredibly unlikely it is that any of us would be here for a thousand, well, an infinite number of reasons almost, but and see, that we should be making the most of the opportunity.
That, I agree, and that's what the position eventually comes down to. Anybody who's a serious believer, beyond, you know, mad mullahs and, you know, people who want to, you know, Christian fundamentalists and everything else, that people come to the idea that actually the point is to behave well. That's what you need to do, and the Stoics would have said that, and so would the Epicureans, because people think that Epicureanism, for example, is about, you know, rogering and eating pies, but actually Epicurus worked out that the greatest pleasure you could have was to live a good life, including pies and wine and jagging, although he didn't do a lot of it himself. So it all comes down to that. The thing is, it's important to do what's right because that's the right thing to do. There's nothing else to say. And it's not, and even in Christianity, you do not get to heaven, and you're deluded if you think you get to heaven by doing good works. You don't. You get there because you've behaved well, by God's grace.
I think if the world's just on average slightly better than it was when you got there because of you, that'd be quite a good thing to have. Yeah. You're going to do lots of bad things and lots of terrible things, but if you can do enough good things to balance that up, but, you know, then it's a definition of what's good and bad, isn't it?
But the thing is, I come to this position not because, you know, I mean, what did it for me was watching my children be born. I think I could not understand where this consciousness came from, where it was so obvious they were conscious as soon as they popped out. It's not about, you know, thinking there's life after death because one's frightened of dying, because I'm sure everybody is. But then there's the other thing, why? Why are people frightened of dying? They don't know anything about it.
But it's also, an for built-in thing. The first 13 billion years of the universe, you weren't here. So it'll just be there's no reason to presume it won't be the same.
But there's no way of proving that. We might well have been here.
Why would you forget? It must have been amazing.
Because I'm getting close to giving it all away. I mustn't do that. I'm going to sell my book. But these things, I mean, it's just a different cast of mind. I don't, you know, I've spent a lot of my life trying to solve difficult problems and make them look, you know, that's what programs are. They're a series of incredibly difficult problems that have been solved and made to look easy. You know, when you watch, you know, Spitting Image, you think, well, that looks easy. You know, some puppets. Was it your idea? Well, that depends what you mean. There are a million ideas in Spitting Image and solving different problems. And so I've come to the conclusion that there aren't any problems, or there shouldn't be any problems. There are insoluble. And this one eludes us. You know, yeah. The meaning of life, why are we here, what should we do about it? It's really annoying to me that it isn't, you can't buy the workshop manual in Smith's, you know. And I want to know why, and there's got to be a reason for that. I don't think things happen without reasons. Ever.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
But more importantly, have you ever tried to suck your own cock? There's something that we can answer yes or no to right now.
Actually, no, I don't think so.
Oh,
disappointing.
Well, I mean, maybe before I was, when I was dip sucking my toes, I might have had a go. I can't remember.
When you were a baby.
That's disgusting.
And let's do the ham hand. Would you prefer, you've heard the question because you were here. Would you prefer to have a hand made? You can ask any questions on top of this. I suspect you might. Is the hand really there at all? Is a hand made out of ham? You can eat the ham, but it'll grow back eventually, but not straight away. Or an armpit that dispenses sun cream enough for you and one other person to get through the year.
This is like talking to Kirsty on Desert Island Discs. Could I have mustard in the armpit instead of suntan cream? Is that what I would go for? I love ham and mustard sandwiches.
But you wouldn't be able to have both, though, would you? You'd have the mustard and then no ham. You can't have the ham and the mustard. You have to make a choice. That's why it's a brilliant question. If you could just say, oh, am I allowed to have gold in the armpit and the hands made out of diamonds? No, that is not the question. The question is a ham and or an armpit that dispenses sun cream. Chris Addison wanted a... other stuff in the armpit. He wanted a surprise at the armpit, which I allowed.
A surprise?
Well, just,
the
you know, you never know what's going to come out. It could be anything. Well, which that's all right, but you can't have the ham hand if you have that.
Could I have my cock in my armpit, for example? that would work for me.
Would you like that? What, so it's easier to suck or just so it's a nice surprise one? You can get on with something else, will you?
Oh, hello, my dear.
It would mean that's you'd have to wank with your
devil. You'd
definitely have to wank with one hand. I think, oh, but no, you'd be all right. You could do an underhand. That'd be like someone else was doing it. Good. Is that the answer? You want a cock in your armpit? Because someone somewhere is going to put these on the internet eventually. Someone's going to give everyone's answer on the internet, and that will, when they Google you, he'd be like, oh, that's the man who wants a cock in his armpit. Have you ever seen a ghost?
No.
No. Disappointing, isn't it? No one has.
But again, it's not something that I would necessarily rule out.
Right.
But no, and I don't personally believe in ghosts, but that, I hesitate, that's just my opinion, it's not a fact. It's not. I'm more right if you. I know you don't believe him because you just.
I did
said
say
so.
Before. Well, you know, you never know, do you?
But there must be something mysterious that you don't believe in that you might come round to, for example.
I'm very open-minded about. I'd love there to be ghosts.
Do you know why things are funny? Do you know what art is?
Do I know what art is?
Do you know why the seed of the sequoia tree is like absolutely tiny? There's like 40,000 of an ounce or something, and you know, it's the biggest tree in the world.
I don't know why that is, no.
No, but the thing is, we don't know... Do you know anything about consciousness? The hard problem, as scientists call it? Do you know what that is?
No. I don't know anything. No. I've just realised.
I'm just saying, but that... It's not... I'm not being... It's not personal, Richard. You know,
seems
you're...
Seems to be.
You're a...
Seems to be like... You've gone to someone and go, do you know what stuff Richard doesn't know about? Yeah, make a list of it and I will... Does he know what's in a carrot? He definitely doesn't know that, John. Put that on the list. They'll look like a fucking idiot.
No, but just saying, it's not. It's certainly in no way is it personal. This is no. Just the thing. Is that's what happens.
That's what makes it personal. The fact he says it's not personal. If he hadn't said it's not personal,
it's just a QI.
I wouldn't
thing.
Have taken it personally. It's the fact he's saying it's not personal that's getting to me. Yeah, sorry.
It's a QI thing. Nobody knows anything very much. They know only a very very narrow range of things, and they don't connect them together, so they don't think about these big. They just take that for granted. They say, "Well, scientists know about that, or artists know about that, or comedians." I said before that somebody offered me a job at university as professor of comedy, and I said, "Well, I can't do that because nobody understands how that works. We know when it works. It's a bit like gravity, you know. We know when it works, but how? Nobody's got any idea. Nobody can tell you how to be funny
or where it comes from."
No.
Because sometimes it feels like it... See, there are things like that, that sometimes it feels like a joke has come fully formed into your brain that you haven't thought about, that it feels like it's been... Most of As It Occurs to Me felt like it had been beamed into my head. Not by someone particularly funny, I have to say. But it was good, at least it was a script.
That's the case in point, is, you know, when we say where does an idea come from? You're an idiot if you say it comes from inside my head. It clearly comes from some... It arrives, it occurs to you. You know, an idea occurred to me, say. It's like you bump into someone in the street. That's what ideas are like to me. And they're mysterious. I remember working with a wonderful physicist called Paul Davis, who briefly considered the idea of being an equitable life ad on television. And we got to talk about things. And I said, this is a question. I just got interested in this stuff. It was when I just had my little bit of a froth. And I said, where do ideas come from? He said, God, that's a brilliant idea. I don't know. I never thought about that. He said, I often like crosswords, you know. He said, when I'm doing crossword, and often something occurs to me, you think, where's that come from? And it's one of the really interesting ideas. Here's another one that I came across the other day. Another thing my son Harry said to me when he was about 14, he said, Dad, can you remember what I was like when I was 2? I said, well, of course, Harry. Like, it was yesterday, actually. He said, why can't I? I thought, that's a brilliant question. That's a really odd, because none of us can we? Maybe one or two incidents. I claim to remember the coronation when I was 2 3/4. I just read in the paper yesterday that this remains one of the big questions of science. Why is that hidden from us?
Because you're a dick, that's why. I mean, so it's just like your brain's too embarrassed to remember how stupid you are. Yeah. Also, if you could remember coming, if you could remember being born, I think you would look at your parents in a different way. So I think there has to be an element where the first...
That's just Stephen Fry's joke, because did you tell that one last week? He said that it's the last time I'm going up one of those.
Though 5%, my wife's in the 5%, he said afterwards. 5% of women.
What?
Well, he said he's got 5% of women that he fancies. My wife's. Well, I don't know if that says she's mannish or not. But, and he's. She's very. As you know, you've seen her. She's way too good for me. So I'm. I'm sorry, darling. I love you. Please don't beat me again afterwards. Are you glad that you ended up not presenting Have I Got News For You? Let's move on to this for a second, and then we'll come back to this. Because I think,
yeah.
Well, before we go on to that, don't you worry by overthinking stuff that you turn into, you overthink stuff so much that you, in fact, go a bit crazy like David Icke and that bloke who was on the Andrew Neil show on Sunday.
Yeah, I did. I used to think that. I used to think that if you start getting interested in these things, you're going to not have a sense of humour and the life is going to be very dull. And actually, you get out the other side of that, I think.
Yeah.
And you believe I know I failed you here tonight, Richard, but I mean, generally, it's...
This is good. This is good stuff, John. I'm not going to start. I'm not going to be personal. This is good stuff. This is really good stuff. Let's because you came up with a format for Have I Got News For You? John Lloyd's News Round. Is that what it was going to be called?
Yeah.
That's a bad name.
It's a terrible title, isn't it? But is Have I Got News For You, actually, the worst title in the world. But it doesn't matter because it's such a good show. So
I think, well, not as bad as Never Mind the Buzzcocks. That is the worst title for... That's just rubbish. But once it's established, it's good. But you were going to host it, or you hosted the pilot.
I did, yeah.
So that could have been a different world of hookers and cocaine for you.
Yeah.
I came with the job.
I wasn't that keen. I was just started directing ads, so I was making loads of money, having a lot of fun. But they asked me to do this. I think in part the idea was, as I'd invented the format on the radio, that if they got me aboard, then people would it would somehow give them, you know, make it look less like stealing, basically, I suppose. because it was strictly owned by the BBC, really, because I was a staff producer.
Was it from the news quiz? Yeah, from the news originally.
But I don't know. The first thing is once you go from radio to telly, you've got to look nice. So I got taken out shopping, and I got bought these suits I would never wear, and strange bright red shoes that I would never put on that didn't fit, and in this rather uncomfortable garb, I. Went into makeup, which had never happened to me before, and the makeup lady's just making me orange, and she said, oh, you're losing your hair, aren't you? That was a horrible thing to say, because I was, you know, it had never occurred to me, I was in my 30s, that I was starting to lose my hair. And so I went out in front of the audience. You can imagine how cheerful I was. The warm-up went down like sick, you know, and I wasn't... I really wasn't very good. And so afterwards I said to Jimmy, the producer, I don't think it's really me, so, and he got a bit cross at me.
He said, we bought you those red shoes.
Yeah,
you're fucking going to present this, even though they're under the desk and we can't
and
see.
And it's hard to imagine, but it was actually, given how famous Angus has become and how brilliant he was at it, he's much better at it than I would have been, is that it was a disaster for them because they very nearly didn't get the pilot picked up because they, believe it or not, wanted me because in the late 80s, you know, I was, you know, quite well known, I suppose. And they thought it would work because I've got on very well with Ian Hislop and Paul Merton in a way that Angus didn't. Is that going to be on the papers tomorrow?
If you go a little bit further, it might be. You can go into details. Well, I think it's clear they didn't. They weren't that bothered when he went, or they kind of seemed to push him a little bit, didn't they?
I think that's probably true.
Yeah. So I think that was fairly clear, at least by that stage. But that's interesting. I've got some questions from the Welsh children. Archie has said, "What's it like being John Lloyd? I want to be in the papers." So we'll ask that because I think we should ask that. I should have asked Mary that. What's it like being? Was that the original question? Yeah. What's it like being John Lloyd?
That's a weird question.
It is,
it?
But so, this is what last week led to us getting on the news. So off you go. Does Andy want to open up about? Have you ever killed a man just to watch him die?
That's a question. I remember when I was casting some kids in a commercial for something or other, and I said to them, they're about seven. What's your mum and dad like? I said, I don't understand what you mean. They're my mum and dad. There's nothing else to say. It's like, what's it like being me? Well, it is just like, it's just, I don't know, it's all I know. So, can anyone else think of a good answer to that question? It seems.
Stephen Fry did pretty well, didn't he? He did all right.
Well, that's when he revealed about.
Yeah, it was,
me.
Yeah, that was the question, which I think it's a kind of question a child would ask, but I think it's sort of an interesting.
Well, I think it's a very, very interesting thing because the question of identity of who you are and whether that extends either side of your apparent birth and death is an interesting idea. And whether people have multiple identities, you know, outside the multiple identities they might already have in life.
You're not going to get in the papers, Archie. I'm sorry, it's not. You're not going
to. I'm determined not to get in the papers.
Well, that's good. It's good not to get in the papers. I work with Richard Bowden on Time, Gentlemen, Please.
Yeah.
He's the director of The Blackadder Goes yeah. Forth. And it's quite interesting. I think this has probably been talked about a little bit, but it's quite interesting the way that the famous scene of Blackadder, the final scene of Blackadder, came about. So did you have a part in that where they all go up out over the trench and they all kind of die and it turns into the poppy fields?
Yeah.
This wasn't a deliberate. This wasn't what you kind of intended, basically, was it?
Well, we intended. It was. It's a really interesting thing, you know, Blackadder being so successful. It's constant frustration that the. Well, I kept saying to Ben and Richard, we must write the episode where they're all just stuck in one room like Hancock's Sunday at Home, you know, because that's classic sitcom. If you could do that, just have five or six characters at the most, and they just talk to each other. You don't need anyone else. And Blackadder doesn't conform to that model. You know, most weeks, in comes Sir Walter Raleigh as the biggest part, or Dr. Johnson, or, you know, Flash Hart, who have these great big set pieces. And I've pushed them for ages to try and do this thing, and they finally come out in the last episode of the last thing, and it's a brilliant, brilliant piece of writing, and I think we all knew it was all over, and it was very moving, and the way that the episode worked, I'm sure many of you have seen it, is it starts very funny and silly, and then gradually all the colour and the laughter drains out of it, becomes quite sad, and even the people you've kind of despised and hated, you see, it's very moving and wonderfully well acted. And what we wanted was then a brilliant scene at the end where they all get killed or probably get killed. And so we took over the whole of one of the studios at Television Centre. The main one had the main sets in it. And the one next door had this amazing no man's land. I went in there, it was seriously scary. I mean, seriously, even without, you know, the lights on. There's something spooky about it. Even if you stood in the set in Blackadder, you went into the trenches and you looked at the psych, you know, the blue sky above and the barbed wire, you just saw. Gives you the creeps, really. So the gallery, as usual, we're overrunning because we've done too many retakes or whatever, something's gone wrong. So there's a PA in the other studio, right, okay, cue all the stuff, lights go on, pyrotechnics, amazing explosions, and the actors hadn't had time to rehearse it, so they're coming up the ladders onto this no man's land which they hadn't even trodden before, and there's loads of earth and bits of real barbed wire and the explosions going off, this dark, you know, and it's like, you know, 2 minutes to ten. I got on the PA and said to the girl, can we just want one more take, please? It's just hopeless. Because it was hopeless. You could see them say, oh, Hugh Laurie, oh, for fuck's sake, what's this? And he's, oh, I just trodden in something. Ah, I caught my leg on this. And it was really terrible, you know. And so Rowan gets on the walkie-talkie and he says, I'm sorry, John, we're basically going on strike. It was really a horrible, horrible experience. Everybody here is really frightened and it's fucking, you know, it's a mess in here, honestly, and it's a disgrace that we should have to do this. I'm sorry, no. So I went home very depressed because it didn't have a decent take, and when we got into the edits and we cut this thing, it was fantastic, you know, and the bit when Rowan blows the whistle and, you know, I have a cunning plan, sir. And we mended it that far, and then we had this awful bit of stuff on the end, and then gradually... It's a wonderful example of teamwork that piece by piece, each person in the room, there are about five or six of us there, I suppose, has a different idea. So the editor, Chris Wadsworth, says, maybe if we put it into slow-mo, we could that maybe just, you know, take the edge off it in some way, maybe extreme slow motion, perhaps. And then the assistant editor said, yeah, I'll tell you what, Chris, what about going to monochrome at the same time, make it black and white? You start, your skin starts to prickle, you think, ooh, that's kind of interesting. And then Howard Goodall had composed the music. It was a single piano and a gym. And then they said, what about slowing the music down as well? And now something really starts to happen. It's this incredibly plangent sound, you know, but mucking around with all the buttons. And then the last thing was that I think the PA said, I've got a great idea. I think I saw a wonderful picture of some poppies up in the photo library. I'll just nip up and get it. So she goes up and does that. And then you've seen the sequence that they go up and the music starts and it's very... Then they all start to fall to earth and then there's this incredibly long mix. It goes on for about 10 to 12 seconds and poppies appear to grow out of this monochrome earth and go red and then it just says Blackadder, 1453 to 1917. And my only contribution on it was to say we can't put credits on this. It would be an insult to all the people who died in that war on either side. So that's... everything else was done by all those other people. I had no creative contribution. As the most extraordinary thing that I call this touching the numinous, sometimes, only about three or four times in my life, you do something which is based on maybe 10 years very hard work and something happens. You get a little thing, you think, ooh. And the abiding thing, people often say, are you proud of that? And I say, well, I'm proud of the people who made it, that I was in the room. I'm proud that I was proud to be with these amazing people who made it happen, who didn't give up under pressure and didn't shout or blame people, which would have been easy to do. And then this thing happened. That was the most amazing thing, because, you know, if top 10 television moments around the world, you quite often see it in there, along with the moon landings, that kind of thing. And that's why I started to be interested in the idea is how much are we actually responsible for anything that really happens to us? Because sometimes it is a sort of God particle moment that something really extraordinary happens that you're really only peripherally involved with. And I took this rough cut home to show it to Sarah, my wife. We'd just got married. We were living in this little one-bedroom flat. It was an open-plan thing with a kitchen and a television and a sofa between. And so I was making some supper for us, very, very proud of this amazing thing that we'd done. And I saw watching it came to an end, and that, you know, that fuzzy bit when the colour bars go and it runs out and it's just the tape just going around blank. And Sarah's sitting there, I just see the back of her head over the sofa. I thought, what a cow, she's fallen asleep, I don't believe it. She's just sitting there motionless. And I went round and I looked at her to see her apparently snoring, and she's just sitting with her eyes open and tears were just pouring down her cheeks. It was really incredibly moving moment. But I say the curious thing is that one's main emotion when there was a sense of humility, of almost embarrassing to have been over-rewarded for something that...
Yeah, but I guess whenever any good comedy show or any piece of art comes together, that's a group effort, is about all the different aspects of that
coming together, so the performance and the writers and, you know, and everything. Chris Wadsworth is a fantastic editor.
He is a brilliant editor.
Good.
Oh. But it is interesting, just that thing of, that's what interests me in life. It interests me is getting to that moment of excellence. And I say you can't legislate for genius. Nobody's a genius, really. But what you can take credit for is in not giving up when things get difficult and you know, trying to go on and on. And just every so often you get these amazing things. We think, and I always have the feeling, always, when I've been involved in something really good, that it's not me. It's that one is a kind of a medium, if you like, a conduit for something larger, some greater consciousness that involves more than one mind.
But if the same person keeps on cropping up in the things that are successful, that does suggest there's a bit more to it than that. So, I mean, you know, everything you've been involved with has been...
But the thing is, okay, so, I'm sorry to go on about this. These things interest me. Okay, so one of the things that I think is that great art, it is impossible to achieve great art with the ego in place. And that what, you know, sportsmen call it the zone, you know, in painting, in dance, and anything, everybody knows that... that feeling when you're doing something really well, that time dilates and you have no sense of self. I get this a lot when I'm film directing. You know, you think film directing is a very arrogant thing to do, but actually it's the reverse. That great film directors actually don't have an ego. They're so focused on the work. And that this, the business of getting connected with some greater... it's not intelligence that I think, intuition, or is when that happens, there's something really magical going on that doesn't involve, you know, men in white beards or anything. It's just that, if I've been good at a few things or done a few good things, it's not really to do with anything to do with talent. It's to do with believing in certain kind of core values of honesty and courage and determination and that kind of stuff. That's what I think
and
it's about.
And probably giving a fuck, isn't it?
Give a fuck. Yeah,
no, exactly. So I think a lot of people, when it goes wrong, it's just you think, oh, people go, oh, that'll do.
Yeah, I don't have that button. No. I don't have a that'll do lever, really, ever.
Do you think that you could have saved The Right Way if you'd produced that? Because that's written by the same person as wrote Blackadder Goes Forth.
Well, I think everybody needs an editor.
Yeah.
And
a bin.
But it just shows you, you know, the thing is that you get famous and regarded, and nobody dares tell you anymore what to do. And an awful lot of my friends have got to that position where they think, yeah, you may be right, yeah, maybe we do good things, but I don't want to be told anymore what to do. And I don't want to be disagreed with. I want to have my own way because that's what I want, and I can have it because I'm rich and famous. And that isn't a very good idea in anybody's, you know, anybody's book.
Could do with a cock joke now, just end it off. I think it's been amazing. You know, it's not... I'd like to see the Daily Mail try and get this into a headline. I'd like to see Eamon Holmes trying to discuss this on Sky Sunrise this week. I don't think it's going to happen, but I'm very glad about that. It was really interesting. Thank you very much. It was not even quite interesting. It was very interesting. Please give it up for John Lloyd, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, John Lloyd. The music is by Pest. Thanks to Orange Mark and everyone at the British Comedy Guide, and to Chris Evans, not that one, or the one from The Avengers, and his team from Go Faster Strike. It was produced by Ben Walker. This is a Fuzz, Go Faster Strike, and Sky Potato production for the internet. How'd you like them Sky Potatoes? Thanks for listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. There's lots of ways you can pay us back for this free podcast. You can go and download video versions of these podcasts for £3.50 a shot, or £15 for the series pass, which will be at least 7 podcasts plus the bonus Pappy's podcast from McKentley. You can go to gofasterstrike.com and just buy some of my DVDs or books.
and that would be a way of me keeping things going and earning some money. You can come and see my live tours. I'm doing a show called We're All Gonna Die, which is going to be the Edinburgh Fringe, 8 o'clock at the Presence Beyond, or Richard Herring's Edinburgh Fringe podcast, which is at Stand 1 at 2:10 pretty much every day of the Fringe. Producer Ben has other podcasts called Do the Right Thing and Pappy's Flatshare Slamdown, which you can also listen to. They're free as well. But if you can spread the word about all these podcasts, that will be another way of helping us. Next week's guest is Russell Brand. It's all sold out on the night, but you can buy the video, or we'll be back up here next week on audio for free. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who's said hello so far. Do come say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.